The Free-for-All Society, part of the Rabbi Victor M. Solomon Summer Learning Series. Welcome to the Rabbi Victor M. Solomon Summer Learning Series. One of my Talmidim approached me regarding the lack of shiurim available for the summer parshia. It's a tremendous zechus to pursue all areas of Torah. But a special zechus exists for those who pursue areas that are not commonly developed. The Briskei Rav and the Chafetz Chaim were well known for developing kachim for this reason. In my area, there are many night kolels and Shabbos and Yontif kolels, specifically to ensure continuous learning when otherwise there may be none. In the same vein, my Talmud has now picked up the mantle to add to the shiurim available on the summer parshia. May this shiur be in memory of and an ilui neshama for Rav Avigdor Mordechai ben Avram Elchanan. Moshe Rabbeinu forewarns the Jewish people in Parshat Re'eh that they can no longer do as we are doing today. Whatever we're doing today must stop. Our current practice, once we enter the land, it's over. But which practice must end? Which practice was it where each man was doing as he wished? It's a fascinating remark. How were they acting freely? What was Moshe Rabbeinu referring to? One guy was eating man with sweet chili, and the other was eating it with garlic. One is keeping Rabbeinu Tam Shabbos, and one the Korah. What's Moshe Rabbeinu referring to? That the people were supposed to act uniformly, but instead they were doing as they wished. Many commentaries on Chumash explain the issue at hand. However, they attempt to limit the scope. The phrase, acting however we want, sounds like an all-encompassing problem that was going on in the generation of the desert. Maybe a belief problem, a full communal breakdown where each man was focused solely on himself and concerned least with his nation? It sounds, in short, like a huge problem. Yet, the Mefarshim limit the scope of the Pasuk's inference. I'll give a few examples. The Ramban suggests it refers to the Karbanot, that until now, we are not obligated to bring any individual karbanot. An individual can bring a karban when he feels like it. Kishabalo, as they say in Hebrew. When he feels like he wants to bring a karban, he brings a karban. But once we cross that Jordan, Moshe says, those days are over. And every man from now on will be bound to preset minimums, such as Maiser Behema, Bechorot, the Aliyah L'Regolim. Everyone will have his yearly obligations and can no longer offer only voluntarily. He'll be able to continue to bring voluntarily, but from now on, he has also obligations. There's a seemingly self-evident problem with this explanation, in that it doesn't seem to quite capture the concept of every man doing as he wishes. Every man can continue to bring karbanot freely. But the pasuk is adding that from now on, there are a few annual requirements that does not really conflict with the unruly and unrestraint being portrayed at the time. They're not contradictory terms. Each man can bring his minimum as an obligation and can continue to offer additional sacrifices as he wishes. So the Ramban's suggestion, what does it mean that the people were acting as they wished and that will need to stop,
The Ramban says it means that they, until now they've brought carbon. No, whenever they wanted, but now there's going to be a minimum. Okay, the Rishbam similarly limits the applicability of this phrase, of this pasuk, and he suggests that it refers to the moving Mishkan. The Mishkan moves around in the desert, and thus we are acting in a freestyle manner. This sweeping statement, each man is acting as he wishes, really what it refers to is the offering of sacrifices in unspecified places. Meaning, wherever the Mishkan goes, that is where we bring our offerings. We were not bringing them wherever we wanted. We were not bringing them whenever we wanted. But the Mishkan moved around, so we were bringing them along with that moving Mishkan. Once we cross into the land, Moshe forewarns, we will have a singular place and no longer a moving center. This answer fits nicely into the larger context of the text, which repeatedly emphasizes the need to worship in the single sacred place, the Makom, that Hashem chose to rest His name. It's the only spot for sacrifices, this parsha emphasizes. It is the only place for pilgrimage, for Aliyah L'Regel. And this Makom, as is referred to 11 times in this parsha, holds exclusive significance, and there's only one of it. The Makom, as it is referred to 11 times in this parsha, beholds exclusive significance, and there's only one of it. While this explanation fits contextually, it too faces similar challenges as does the Ramban. The phrase, each man doing as he wishes, seems to be all-encompassing, a significant erosion of the national fabric. There's a problem on a huge scale. Everyone is acting as he wishes, yet the Rashbam limits its applicability to the freeness that essentially Hashem was choosing each time they traveled. That Hashem picked new places for resting His Shechina. And Moshe comes along and forewarns the people, this will no longer continue, and rather there will be only one place for worship. These commentaries, the Ramban, the Rashbam, and there are others as well, are clearly reducing the scope of Moshe's rebuke, so much so that the shmooze barely comes off as rebuke. One of the reasons for the minimization of this pasuk, the Ramban himself addresses. Moshe Rabbeinu, after all, includes himself in the lesson and says, we can no longer continue doing as we've been doing today. Well, we? Was Moshe also doing this? What was Moshe doing wrong along with the people? And thus, these verses, these psukim, must only be instructional and informative of the upcoming changes and not homiletical. It's not a sermon. It's not tochacha. It's just an informational update. Keep in mind, there will be only one place and Hashem will not be moving around anymore. You will no longer bring only voluntarily, you'll also have obligations. Okay. However, Shmuel Anavi, who authored Sefer Shoftim, brings us a different perspective on these psukim, and it's a perspective that I believe makes these psukim so very relevant to us today. This phrase of each man doing as he wishes appears in two and only two other places in Tanakh. A total of three times. One here in Parshat Re'eh, and two other times in Sefer Shoftim. In Perik Yud Zayin, and then the very last Pasuk. So being the very last Pasuk, it ends up having a lot of prominence, people know of it. Sefer Shoftim can be categorized into three sections. Number one, the people's incomplete conquest of the land. Really, Sefer Yehoshua details their incomplete conquest. But in Shoftim, that first section deals with the outcome of never having completed the conquest. Section two is their unfinished destruction of Avodah Zarah. They allowed the Avodah Zarah to continue to exist and spread. And three, their ultimate state of hypocrisy, living with two beliefs, Hashem and the idols. Meaning one of the outcomes of not destroying the Avodah Zarah was that they eventually took idols into their own world. They joined the culture and they assimilated into the idolater's world. So chapter Yud Zayin opens the third section, which is the ramifications of living a two-faced life. And this third section continues to tell us the horrific stories of Pesel Micha and Pilegish Begivah, as I'll describe a little bit. It introduces the story in Pasuk Yud Zayin, in Perek Yud Zayin. This section is introduced with the Pasuk, there is no king of Israel, and each man is doing as he wishes. The whole section, that third section, ends, and the whole Sefer ends, with this Pasuk, the very same Pasuk that Perek Yud Zayin has close to its beginning. There is no king, and each man is doing as he wishes. Same idea. And this phrase, each man is doing as he wishes, again appears three times in all of Tanakh. One at the beginning of Perek Yud Zayin and Shoftim. The world of living a two-faced life, the end of that section, and in Parshat Re'eh. And Shmuel HaNavi chose those very words to point to the people's betrayal of Hashem. The people's duplicity. Shmuel could have chosen any set of words, but he chose this very phrase, which appears only once in the entire Torah. So apparently, Shmuel HaNavi is revealing to us how he used it, how he understood it. It means that the people in the desert, in Parshat Re'eh, and in their years of sojourning in the desert, they were most probably serving Hashem and idols. They had already picked it up from foreign cultures. They were no longer enslaved by Egyptian masters. Slaves don't have time to think. They do not have time to develop culture by choice or take up new beliefs. They're beaten and live either the life of continual yearning for survival, or subsist in the abyss of despair. There's no time to think, there's no time to dream, or to worship anything. Atheism remains at an all-time low for the Jews in Egypt because there's no time to actually develop anything but what they were raised with. In between beatings, you look up to the Eibishter and ask for salvation. There's no breathing room for new discoveries. But now they're in the desert. In the big time. And they're free to set their eyes on new sights, on expanding horizons. They find idolatry wherever they go. Midian, Moab, Sichon, Ammon, all around them. There are idols. And Moshe now rebukes them. You better not continue this way. This is what Moshe is forewarning them about. What we're doing today. We're dancing at two parties. And it must stop. Well, what's the story of Pesel Micha? In short, there's a Pesel, an idol made and worshipped by Micha. And another group of Jews come along and masterfully steal it. However, the longer story portrays a people who have Shem Hashem on their lips. They say Baruch Hashem, but simultaneously steal and worship idols. Pilegesh Begiva is a more horrific story. One of a hideous murder, and then an ensuing civil war. Why do such terrible things occur? Shmuel Anavi answers the question. Because there's no king. And each man is living out the hypocritical life of embracing Hashem and idols together. That's the sweeping phrase. Each man is doing as he wishes. Once we are no longer devoted solely to Hashem, then we could be reduced even to full civil war and even to the most heinous crimes. This message is found in other places in Tanakh as well. To mention just two others. Yehoshua. In the end of Sefer Yehoshua, he warns people that they have a choice. They can either choose Hashem or not. Just choose. The people choose Hashem. But then Yehoshua repeats it. And when they again confirm, Chas v'shalom, Yehoshua. We would never consider anything else. We're with you. We're with Hashem. He then turns to them and yells at them. So then get rid of your idols. They didn't even seem ready to admit that they were dabbling in both belief systems at the same time. They were not giving their full undivided devotion to Hashem. They didn't realize there was something problematic in living two different lives. They were either stonewalling the message, or perhaps worse, they may have even been oblivious. My colleague, Rav Ziv, added two of the mitzvahs to Midios. There are mitzvahs that the Be'er Halacha, at the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, lists that are mitzvahs to think about all the time. The first one is to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The second one is to believe that He's only one. Aren't those the same? If you believe in Hashem, then you believe He's only one? Well, apparently that's a big chiddush for the people in the desert in the time of Yehoshua and the time of Shoftim. And it took a while for the people to chop this point. They went to Davin, but then they would steal. They would go look up to Hashem, and then they'd look up to their idols. Similarly, we find this perhaps by Yaakov Avinu. He's finally ready to ascend to Beit El, to go bring his promised sacrifice. And he turns to his family members, and he says, you must rid yourselves now of all idols. What idols? Apparently they too had been playing around with both. Perhaps that is why Yaakov had waited so long to bring his promised carbon altogether. Maybe he was waiting to finish his Kiruv mission, to get his whole family on board as full believers? Maybe. Idols were all over the place. Everyone was doing it. Everyone was saying that idols were the way to go. And don't put all your eggs in the monotheistic basket. Comes Yaakov Avinu. And it's now time to get closer to Hashem. Comes Moshe Rabbeinu and says it's now time to cross the Yarden and enter Eretz Yisrael. Yehoshua comes now and says, It's now time to develop Am Yisrael properly in the land. And they all give the same rebuke. Stop living double lives. We do this today. How many continue to pick and choose what they wish to believe and what they wish to leave? What they wish to take seriously and what they wish to reject outright? Are we all learning to gain deeper insight? Do we care? Are we not living double lives? Are we devoted and committed fully to Hashem? We must keep in mind that Shmuel HaNavi is not pleased with the people's request for a king. Yet Shmuel HaNavi repeats this mantra in Sefer Shoftim, that there's no king in Israel. A king offers two great assets. He brings the nation to a united front to develop the country economically, strategically for battles, and politically. It is most probably a necessity to have a king. But that is not Shmuel HaNavi's desire for kingship. His problem is with the religious breakdown, the lack of sincerity in the people's devotion to Hashem. There is no king, he forewarns, from Perek Yud Zayin to the end of Sefer Shoftim. This phrase that no king exists appears three times. In the opening of Perek Yud Zayin, there is no king and everyone is doing what they want. In the beginning of Perek Yud Ches, there's still no king. And in the end of the Sefer, there's still no king and everyone is doing what they want. He repeats the point that everyone is doing what they want, connected to the point that there's no king of Israel. To Shmuel HaNavi, it means that Am Yisrael is not fully connected to Hashem. Why do they want a king in the end? When they approach Shmuel and Sefer Shmuel? For war, not for their devotion. They do not ask for Musar Shmuzes, for more Shiurim, for more Torah power, for more connection to Hashem. What do they ask for? For politics. That annoys Shmuel. Avodah Zarah, hypocrisy, what's going to be with that? Who's going to solve that? When are they going to yearn to correct that? Is that not the main issue? Well, if you front load the secondary item, then the main point may never be dealt with in life. If we wait to learn Torah, we may never get to it. By the time we're retired, we may have become foreigners to Torah. It needs to be a constant focus. If we don't rid ourselves of foreign pursuits that are not accepted by the Torah, then our ascent to Beit El may never come about. With Rosh Hashanah near, we need to ask ourselves the introspective questions. How many of our daily and weekly activities push God aside? How many of our thoughts simply sidestep Him? Moshe Rabbeinu's message is relevant to every one of us, including humanity in the 21st century. It is within our grasp to recognize what we are and what we are not doing, if we are answering the call of the Torah. Unfortunately, our enemies have been uniting for the purpose of destruction. Hopefully we can unite for grandeur, which does not lie in the number of Nobel Prizes we win, or the number of high-tech companies we sell, but in how devoted we are to Hashem. That needs to be our individual and national focus. Bezrat Hashem, with everyone working even slightly on this, it should have a positive ripple effect, an immeasurable impact, and together we will ascend to Beit El.